and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
We have about 10, 12 years to get the climate problem really under control and to really start to bring down our emissions. I hope governments will start to shift towards this higher intervention again and to introducing a carbon price, because the alternatives are much worse.
We talk about environmental taxes and making them fair. But before that, we'll go straight to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, this is a Brexit-free zone this month. other than to say that, well, the Brits are busy shooting themselves in the foot, the French have been pretty busy as well, organising themselves. And there's been a hugely popular movement called the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests. And it's been reported widely in the media that it was a revolt against a green tax on fuel. Now, you're a French speaker. You've been in France just in the last few days, and you've been talking to people in Brittany and Paris involved with the protests. So what did you learn from them about this?
Oui, c'est vrai, je parle français. So I was in Brittany for a week and then in Paris, one of the weekends where the Gilets Jaunes, these high-vis jacket militants, as they call themselves, were on the streets in Paris. And they were everywhere, everywhere in Brittany, wherever we went. I went to five cities whilst I was there, doing a kind of tour, talking with different audiences in different cities. And the Gilets Jaunes actually attended a couple of the events I was involved with, or rather representatives of Gilets Jaunes. The first thing I'd say is they are not aligned with one party or another. You're right, they're neither left nor are they right in the traditional sense. They're not aligned with any trade unions. There are obviously trade union members there and other movements. Some commentators, certainly in the British and North American press, have tried to link them to radical hard-right movements, including the National Rally of Marine Le Pen, but that just isn't the case. There might well be some far-right activists involved in the movement, and indeed there might well be quite a number of agents provocateurs stirring up violence, for example, in Paris. But most of the people I met in Brittany who identify themselves as Gilets Jaunes were self-employed builders, electricians, taxi drivers, care workers, nurses, hospital porters, catering staff. None of them consider themselves to fall into the traditional or typical, what you might typically label as a political activist. Most of the people I spoke with on the roundabouts in cities in Brittany like Quimper and Brest, they were in their 40s or 50s. Some of them were even older than that. But I also saw lots of lycée students, young secondary school students, demonstrating in support of the Gilets Jaunes. And in their case, they were carrying placards supporting their teachers and classroom assistants and the catering staff at the school. So yeah, this seems to cut right the way through a very large range of demographics. The overwhelming impression I got in Paris and Brittany was that there was a huge groundswell of support for the Gilets Jaunes, and I've heard figures of up to 80% of the population in France support them. Huge concern about this gulf between the political class in Paris and the rest of the country, and a genuine sense that the president, Emmanuel Macron, has simply no understanding or personal experience of the lives that most people in France lead, and that is a really big issue there. Just to get a feel for the chasm that people see existing between Macron's government and the rest of the country, one of the ministers in his cabinet has complained publicly about how hard it is to dine out in Paris on less than 200 euros per person, and that doesn't include the wine. And that just adds to the sense that President Macron and his entourage have re-established the Gilded Age of Versailles in Paris.
Yeah, and this is all about tax justice and inequality, isn't it? We've had all sorts of outrageous things that Macron did right from the start of becoming president. He got rid of some of the wealth taxes that were there. He cut corporate taxes. Even, I think, yacht fuel is exempt from this new tax. I mean, it's just an endless list of how not to create a grassroots movement of very angry people.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think the media, particularly in Europe and in North America, have not quite grasped the depth. It's kind of been presented as a reaction against an environmental tax, and it isn't that at all. That's completely misunderstanding it. There certainly is an issue around the proposals to add to the existing fuel duties on petrol and diesel, but there are so many other underlying grievances and a general sense that whilst President Macron has been giving tax breaks to rich people and the cronies that surround his government and his party and to powerful corporations, while at the same time they're loading all the charges onto lower income households in France, this is a real economic justice, tax justice struggle. So all the activists I met were enraged, and that's the right word. They used the word enraged about his abolition of wealth taxes. They were introduced in the 1980s, and they were levied on people with assets valued at over 1.3 million euro. And most people seem to think that that was a reasonably fair cut-off line. Now, this abolition of the wealth tax was simply seen as Macron pandering to his friends and to his cronies. And no one believed his argument that this was necessary as an incentive to encourage rich people to invest in new jobs in France. Now, what made matters even worse was the suggestion from the government that the wealth tax might be replaced by a real estate tax. But, and this is what really made people's blood boil, the plan was to exempt, as you say, to exempt yachts and supercars and jewellery and all the other things that the super rich like to embellish themselves with. So this was really seen as a tax cut for the plutocrats. And whilst duties on car fuels were being pushed up significantly, no attempt was being made to impose duties on yacht fuels, as you said, or on private jets.
Or on any airline fuel is exempt from tax as well.
That's right, and they've all been exempt from duty for decades. And this has just worsened the sense that Macron protects the interests of the ultra-rich and their super yachts moored off the coast at Cannes and in Nice and all of that. But he really doesn't care about the people in rural France who have to drive to work. They have to drive to work because the bus services don't meet their needs. Now, wherever I went, in Brittany and in Paris, I heard Macron being described as the plutocrat's president. Now, another complaint is that despite all the rhetoric about tackling corporate tax avoidance and evasion, little or nothing is being done. One of the Gilets Jaunes demands relates to the tax cheating by the largest French companies on the CAC 40 stock exchange. Those companies are estimated to cost 80 billion euro a year in lost tax revenues. Most of the people I spoke with felt that in particular he's protecting the interests of the banking class. And of course, that's his background. He is himself a merchant banker or an investment banker. One of the demands made explicitly to the president in the last couple of weeks is that stronger measures need to be taken to prevent looting of African countries, and in particular, the French-speaking African region, Françafrique. Again, that's a clear tax justice issue. This is not a bunch of people who are anti-tax. They are anti this trend which we've seen right the way across the world in the last 40 years of lowering the tax charge on the wealthy and increasing the tax charge on the less well-off. And I haven't had that impression coming through that much from the international media.
No, that's true. And when we look at Macron's response to the Gilets Jaunes movement, he made a national address on TV in a golden encrusted room in the Élysée Palace. You know, I mean, he couldn't have found a more opulent room. What could he actually have done differently? Because what he's ended up doing is really giving a bad name to environmental taxes, which is really a shame.
Yeah, I think that's entirely a fair comment. I mean, I listened very carefully to his speech and it was full of platitudes and warm words and recognition that, you know, he could do things better. Yes, he could have done things so much better. I think he has done in the environmental movement a really big disservice, because the way he was introducing these higher fuel duties on cars is a textbook example of how not to introduce new environmental taxes. For decades, we've known that taxing hydrocarbon fuel is regressive in its impact on lower income households, largely because lower income households spend a larger proportion of their income on heat and on transport because their incomes are so much lower. So if you want to use the tax system to encourage people to use other forms of transport and not use cars, you need, first of all, to provide a viable substitute in the form of cheap and reliable public transport. Now, that's the core of the problem in rural Brittany, because public transport there is neither cheap nor reliable, and people were finding it really hard to get to work. If you're doing your shift but starting first thing in the morning or late at night, then the public transport just wasn't there. Now, you've got to address that problem first and then increase fuel duties to encourage people to substitute buses, trams and trains for cars.
Having had proper interaction and communication in the first place many months before.
Absolutely. Explain what you're doing and explain why you're doing it, and then you're going to carry the people along. Because trust me, none of the Gilets Jaunes I spoke with are anti-environment. They understand climate change. They just need to get to work first thing in the morning, you know, and that's fully understandable. I don't think this has anything at all to do with climate change denial. They actually want the better public services. They want to play their part in cutting down on car usage. They just need to have the infrastructure in place to enable them to do it beforehand. Macron, he is a neoliberal who felt very, very sure that he could push these things through without public support. Now, within days of the big events on the Champs-Élysées, he was forced to concede on the full fuel duties. He was forced to offer higher pension increases, a higher minimum wage. It's the violence that has made him pay attention and start taking action. That's very sad. It tells me that democracy in France needs a reboot and that Macron needs to learn the skills of democracy, which above all means listening to people.
Thanks, John. Yeah, let them eat cake doesn't really cut it. Actually, I think Marie Antoinette's supposed to have said, let them eat brioche. Anyway, it's time now for the TaxCast special feature. When it comes to the climate crisis facing us all, most of us want our governments to take meaningful and effective action. We've had decades of dark money discrediting the science, decades of governments not investing in a new economy, not pricing carbon properly to reflect the damage it's doing, yet continuing to subsidise the polluters. But time's running out. And this month on the TaxCast, we talked to the authors of a new report, A Climate of Fairness: Environmental Taxation and Tax Justice in Developing Countries. Probably the best place to start is if we talk about how compatible environmental taxation is with the principles of tax justice. With the Tax Justice Network, we're always talking about the four R's of tax and the fact that tax isn't just about raising revenue. You know, it's about redistribution, repricing, encouraging or discouraging certain consumption patterns, and, you know, ultimately representation, and that's all about accountability. So there is a lot of crossover here, isn't there, with environmental taxation and tax justice?
Yeah, the thing about environmental taxes and about any kind of consumption taxes is that they are inherently and by definition regressive, right?
This is Tatiana Falsal, co-author of the Climate of Fairness report.
Because you are trying to change consumer behavior, you're imposing a tax that will affect everyone. There is no progressivity in the way the tax is applied. But on the other hand, you are generating additional revenues, which will be used for a purpose. So the purpose could be to redistribute to the ones that were affected most by the tax. So in that way, you have a redistribution element inbuilt into the way that the tax is conceptualized. And you could put it towards a fund in order to foster new technological developments. You could use it to release burdens associated with other types of social harm within society, so to alleviate poverty and to, you know, invest in education. So it really depends on the way that the policy is framed, how you were going to address those four R's. In our report, we say that ideally an environmental tax should actually lead to some form of redistribution in order to alleviate the harmful impact and the regressive impact of the tax. Most countries will have difficulties with earmarking revenues. And so, in a way, just the fact that the revenues will be directed to the general budget means that it can be used to alleviate the harmful effects of the tax.
Right. And if we look at what's going on in France at the moment, it's kind of like a textbook example of how not to impose a so-called green tax, right?
Right. So yeah, the French example is probably a textbook example of how not to start a new policy on environmental taxation, basically because I think they didn't do any of the publicization of the policy that they should have done, so that, you know, you don't have the case that I think is what happened in France of a consumer arriving at the gas station one day and finding out that the price has been hiked by a higher percentage.
But his proposal itself to equalise diesel and gasoline prices, I think that's a good one.
Jacqueline Cottrell, co-author of the Climate of Fairness report.
If you have a very high carbon price for one kind of fuel, gasoline, and a much lower price for another, diesel, then people will purchase more diesel vehicles and more diesel will be consumed. And as we know now, in terms of health impacts, that's really disadvantageous. He didn't think about how to take the social side into account. There was not enough consideration taken to what alternatives would be available for people living in rural areas in France who had diesel vehicles. You know, if he had communicated in a different way, had made clear what the advantages and the disadvantages of the status quo in France might have been, and have made very clear these are the revenue reallocation measures that are going to accompany this policy, then I think the outcome could have been very different. You know, there are very successful carbon taxes, say in Sweden, they have a very high carbon tax by now. I think it's €128 per tonne of carbon, and they've implemented that in 1991. They've increased it gradually over time. They've communicated very clearly what the revenues are used for and that it's a revenue neutral tax and that it's part of a broader process of fiscal reform. There's also cross-party agreement on that. So in Sweden, it's a very well accepted measure.
Right. And in the report, you say that very few countries are, and I'm quoting now, very few countries are on the right path to get to the required level of taxation by the due date. So they're just not prepared. And what does that actually mean? That's pretty serious.
Yeah, so there isn't actually an ideal level of taxation. The Paris Agreement doesn't set that. But I think the first step should be for every country to understand that they have to have a carbon price. So obviously, a carbon price that is applied by a developed country will not be the same carbon price applied by a developing country, because you have to take into account there are different levels of economic development and there are different social constraints. But every country should have a carbon price. And by that, I mean, what is the price that will be significant enough to stir change in consumer behavior and to make society switch into a cleaner modus of operation, so basically reducing carbon dioxide consumption. It doesn't matter that that initial carbon price may be relatively small. The experience we have from Nordic countries who introduced their carbon taxes in the 90s was that they started with a rather low carbon price, and they've been able to increase it significantly over the course of the last 20 to 30 years. And now they have actually quite high carbon taxes, almost to the point where it's $130 per ton of carbon. That's quite high. I always cite the example of Finland, because Finland has become so dependent on this revenue that comes from carbon taxation. And they've seen a change in consumer behavior. So in effect, consumers are acquiring less carbon intensive products. So they've seen a reduction in the revenue collection ability coming out of the carbon tax. And so what they're doing now is they're introducing a stockpile fee in order to compensate for that loss of revenue. The government has been so reliant on this tax as a revenue that is now having to create a new tax to compensate for the loss of revenue. So it's a positive example. It shows that the tax really leads to a change in consumer behavior, and that it can achieve the desired effect. But obviously, you know, a small country like Finland can have a less significant impact than, for example, Russia or, you know, the United States or Brazil. So, you know, you have to be able to also convince these countries, these large polluters, and because of the size of their economies, that they have to have a carbon price that will start this process.
Right. And all of this obviously must go hand in hand with investment in green technology and renewable energy, right?
Yeah, that's a really important feature of the carbon tax, that is that it is capable of generating additional resources.
Okay. And developing countries or emerging economies that are resource rich can be hit very hard by environmental taxation. And obviously, the last thing you want to do is hit a country that's very dependent on very often just one resource export. You make a series of proposals on countries joining together to implement a carbon pricing strategy through border tax adjustments and another scheme similar to the existing so-called Red Plus scheme. It's a kind of compensation scheme, which is the Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation scheme. Can you tell us a bit about that last one?
Yeah, I mean, we developed the first idea that this might work. This isn't a really well worked out proposal at this stage, but we thought it would be really interesting to tie in with the existing Reducing Emissions from Deforestation, Forest Degradation, this Red Plus scheme, which is already well established within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And what we would like to see happen is that developed countries could, instead of giving developing countries money not to remove forest-based CO2, to give them that money to not extract fossil fuels from the ground. And it's a really important issue because so much of the funds and foreign exchange that some of the poorest countries in the world have actually comes from the export of fossil fuels. And the fossil fuel reserves in developing countries, excluding China, we can see that they're worth about $21 trillion. This is a huge amount of money that if we want to tackle climate change, we're asking these countries not to cash in on, if you like. And we really have to think hard about how we can have a mechanism that could address that issue. So what we proposed there was to really have the Red Plus scheme, but have that focused on fossil fuel extraction instead. So developed countries would simply pay developing countries to not extract a proportion, at least, of their fossil fuels in the same framework that we now have the Red Plus agreement. It's actually quite easy to calculate, in as much as we can look at the fossil fuels that are not extracted and put a price on that, either on the basis of the international global price. We could think about avoided emissions. We could think about what the carbon price should be for that. And there would be quite a lot of advantages for developed countries on the one side. If they're permitted to use the payments for avoided emissions in their own countries, developing countries would receive financial compensation, so they'd have an interest in it as well. It live up to the international principle of common but differentiated responsibility, which is really important. From a climate justice perspective, it's really important that these countries are compensated for not extracting the fossil fuels. The key factor that would need to be in place would be political will internationally. And it depends a bit what comes out of the climate conferences in the coming 1, 2, 3 years, 2018, 19 and 2020, to see whether there's a possibility to feed in that idea to those ongoing discussions about how to implement the Paris Agreement.
The poorest people in some of the poorest countries in the world are pretty much bearing the brunt in terms of what climate chaos can do. How do you devise environmental taxes to make them innovative enough to help target that kind of inequality, lifting them out of poverty? You've done an assessment of many of the schemes around the world. Can you tell me about some good examples of taxes that would target that specifically?
Yeah, sure. One of the country cases that we looked at was Morocco, which actually introduced a tax on plastics imports and on inputs into the manufacturing process as well, which had an initial rate of 1.5% on the value. And then that was reduced to 1% as the scope of the tax was widened. And what that actually did, because the increase on each plastic product was actually very small for the individual consumer, that meant that the social impact was relatively little, but nonetheless, there was a price signal there for manufacturers who were making very large amounts of plastic bottles, let's say, to think about their efficiencies, to think about using recycled plastics, which were exempt from the tax, and to think about how to improve their resource efficiency and reduce their waste. So you could see there that although there was an impact on the way that the economy worked and the way that plastics were used through the economy, there was very little social impact. And the revenues that were used there were really focused on improving social outcomes. So, for example, they used quite a large proportion of the tax revenues to support waste pickers, to create collectives, to formalize waste recycling processes, which created more than 1,000 jobs. It created formalized jobs as well, which is really important. So people start to have better access to social welfare and to health because they're included within the more formal tax sector. You can see that they use revenues as well to close down unsanitary waste dumps. So you've got lots of positive health impact as well there. Yeah, they estimate that damage costs actually halved between 2000 and 2014 because of these improvements to conditions in terms of not just waste, but other issues as well. But you can really see that there are these concrete improvements as a result of the tax. And I think there's a lot of potential for many more countries to be using revenues in that way. If you look at the Addis Ababa Action Agenda, one of the means that was agreed in that for fulfilling the Agenda 2030 and the idea of meeting the Sustainable Development Goals was to use domestic resource mobilization to raise the revenues necessary to eradicate poverty, to improve healthcare, to address climate change issues. So we can see there that if you use environmental taxes to raise these revenues and you think carefully about how the revenues are recycled, you're really generating a win-win. On the one hand, you've got your environmental improvement due to your tax, but the revenues that you raise, you can use to protect people socially, but also to bring about improvements in health, in the natural environment, and to take other steps that are necessary to meet the Sustainable Development Goals.
And there's a very intelligently designed scheme in Indonesia.
Yes, what happened in Indonesia was there were fossil fuel subsidies. So what the Indonesian government decided to do was to reform the subsidies, not actually to introduce a carbon price as yet, though that will be the next step, I think, in their policy. But what they did, first of all, when the oil price was quite low in 2014, 2015, they made the decision to phase out subsidies for fossil fuels, first of all in the transport sector for diesel and gasoline, and then later for electricity. And the way that they did that to reduce opposition, they thought about which fuels were used more by richer parts of society. So they focused on gasoline first, followed that with diesel, which tends to be used by poorer income groups. And then they already had revenues free to start reallocating those revenues towards social protection measures and other measures. And then finally looking at electricity and how they could best reform subsidies in the electricity sector while still protecting the poorest households again. So they had very clever policy sequencing in the Indonesia case. And between 2014 and 2017, they had a really substantial amount of revenues that were freed up, which were used for increased investment in education, which went up in that time frame. So only in 3 years by 11% and about 53% increase in spending on healthcare and 119% on infrastructure. So you could really see a strong shift there from subsidizing fossil fuels towards putting the money in sectors that we need to see invested in to achieve sustainable development goals.
What would you ideally like to see now, given the short period of time left for governments to take action? Very often, certainly in the tax justice world and financial transparency campaigning, what has happened is that many of the guilty parties, should we say, some of the tax havens, for example, would always say, oh, but there must be international cooperation. Of course, as soon as there's international cooperation, we will absolutely, you know, conform, but we don't want to do something that other locations aren't doing. And that has delayed and delayed and delayed. How much would you put the emphasis on unilateral action by countries, and how much is it absolutely necessary that there must be this international cooperation?
I think the easiest approach at the moment, and the most efficient way of getting things going, is for every country to start acting independently and act unilaterally while we are not able to get to an international consensus. International consensus is very difficult to achieve, and it requires a lot of time and you know, a lot of coordination. And we unfortunately have in the world a growing movement where countries are looking more inward, so more towards their own national issues and their own domestic issues. You see that happening in the US, you see it happening in Italy, where I am at the moment. Brazil is also, you know, there's a movement, an inward-looking movement for the last decades. And so I think that the most efficient way would be for countries to establish their own carbon prices. And I really reiterate that it doesn't have to be a super high price. It doesn't have to be as significant as the price that Sweden is applying. In fact, a carbon tax policy is ever the more efficient when it starts quite low, and you inform the population of how it will progress over time. And so you have a plan so that industry can prepare for the tax. And you have a plan, you know, a long-term plan where this tax will be increased over time. At least then you have initiated a process of acceptance within your own country. And when you come to discuss these issues on an international sphere, you can already start from somewhere, you know, like you've already achieved a level of understanding within your own country that having a carbon price is needed. And then you can already negotiate your way into a certain international carbon price that will be admissible considering your own levels of economic and social development.
What I think at this stage is what's really important to happen is that we do have these pioneer countries who are showing the way for other countries as well. So we have countries that are a bit braver and impose a higher carbon price than other countries. I think the countries that do take these steps benefit from them as well. I've just been working in Costa Rica, and you can see there that there's an awful lot has gone on to drive renewable energy deployment in the country. And they have an electricity sector which is almost entirely based on renewable energy, hydro, wind, slowly more and more solar is being rolled out. So you can really see that there are these countries that can hold themselves up as pioneers, and they do have something to gain from that.
Right. And the United States' own governmental US Global Change Research Program warned recently that the US economy could suffer before the end of the century a 10% hit. So obviously this is all about survival and self-interest as well. And you can argue, obviously, governments have already been incentivizing markets in the wrong way. And this is a case for incentivizing in a different way from the massive subsidies there's been for oil and coal industry, for example.
Yes. Governments are very familiar with subsidizing particular industries, you know, the fossil fuel industries all over the world. So that's obviously also a market intervention. And there's very little sensible economic argument in favor of that. And there are a lot of very strong, very rational economic arguments in favor of imposing a price on carbon. And that's no more or less interventionist than a fossil fuel subsidy. Sure, it's the same mechanism in essence. It's whether you have a negative price, the fossil fuel subsidy, or a positive price, the price in carbon.
Yes, so what the climate crisis is showing us very clearly is that state intervention is essential for our survival. Yet many governments are going in the opposite direction. You know, markets must prevail. Politically, it all looks less likely than maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
Yes, at the same time, if we are serious about meeting climate targets, there's absolutely no way that governments can afford to step back and not take responsibility, in essence, for creating a regulatory framework within which our economies can transition onto a low carbon path. We can see even amongst the business community, there's some pushback to the approach taken in America at the moment, let's say by Donald Trump, which is very much, you know, the Republican low regulation approach. But I don't see that happening all over the world. And I think there are a lot of political actors who are very much opposed to that state of affairs and to the step back that we have now and would like to see a shift towards the other direction. And I think as we have about 10, 12 years to get the climate problem really under control and to really start to bring down our emissions, I hope governments will start to shift towards this higher intervention again and to introducing a carbon price, because they see that the alternatives are much worse and that they see there is no other way for it to happen, that governments have to take that responsibility.
You can find the report, A Climate of Fairness, Environmental Taxation and Tax Justice in Developing Countries, on the Vienna Institute for International Dialogue and Cooperation website on www.vidc.org. Well worth a read. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.